Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So, whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1187.EC0409, certificate number 26170. Solidarnosc.
When the government yet again raised food prices in the summer of 1980, workers at the Gdansk shipyard staged an illegal strike.
We'd like to ask ourselves on this show whether our topics are compatible with Marxism.
It's the number one thing. Remember when we were wondering if the Columbia Pictures lady was compatible with Marxism or the real life bear that Winnie the Pooh was based on?
If you think about the two poles of Omnibus politically, we can't tax the rich because of all the great work they do in the world.
So many of history's great eccentricities would not have existed if not for people with too much time on their hands.
But are the rich compatible with Marxism?
See, often they're not.
Yeah.
That's the thing about the rich. Even if they talk a good game on, about Bernie Sanders online.
Right.
You know, if somebody wants to put low-income housing near Dave Chappelle,
oof,
sometimes he gets mad.
He does. He withdraws his support from the local golf course.
Man, I wish I had enough power to withdraw my support from anything, really.
But what would you say? Do you think that leftism is compatible with Marxism?
Like this current state of American leftism, such as it is?
No, I would specifically unionism, labor unions, are they compatible with Marxism?
They should be.
They should be.
And yet.
They so often aren't.
Thereby hangs a tale today.
It's so tricky.
I guess in theory, they're compatible with all kinds of democratic socialism. And yet, just like anybody else, you put Marxists in power and they don't want to hear anything from anybody.
It's pretty tricky.
Much less
isn't it?
Labor unions.
Yeah. Although labor unions are very definitely a movement of the worker.
Wow.
And so is Marxism.
I'm going to write a PhD dissertation in history about how labor unions are definitely a movement of the worker.
Yeah, I think I can say that.
In short, Poland is a land of contrasts.
And I'm not sure if labor unions have really any bearing on whether or not you can tax the rich. I think you could have labor unions and also not tax the rich.
I mean, once the rich have enough power to determine tax policy, they're also, in parallel, tend to be weakening labor unions.
Right, but labor unions could defeat the rich and still not have imposed any tax on them.
That's
they could
true.
Defeat them through the power of organizing.
Labor organizers could say, look, we want a good living wage. We want benefits.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want our kids in coal mines anymore.
Right. We want to have good retirements from a lifetime of solid work.
We don't want our fingers falling off because they made us like stir the uranium powder
exactly.
with our bare hands.
Exactly.
And yet we don't think there should be a billionaire tax because those guys like us are doing good work.
Sure they are. Sure they're buying mining companies and
they're interested in all kinds of weird fads and vanity projects that will someday future power many a future podcast.
Space exploration and electric trucks and all kinds of cool things.
None of which work.
Right.
But you really got to admire the moxie.
Oh, did you see the other day that all of those satellites got hit with a space bomb?
No.
Oh, yeah. There was a solar flare. And
are these whose new satellites are these? Elon's?
Well, what are the ones? What are SpaceLink or whatever? Is that Elon? Yeah. You know, SpaceX has been throwing up a bunch of Elon Musk satellites, and not just
they're all shaped like his head.
Yeah, not just 1955 Camaros, but all kinds of, you know, it's building the whole space network.
People are mad.
But there was a solar storm, and 40 of them got blasted by space rays and like fell into the atmosphere and burned up and are just like gone.
You know what? That's the number of Tesla Model 3s that's an ambulance every hour. So who cares?
that must have been expensive and a big disappointment, right? All the people at SpaceX headquarters deep, deep under a volcano must have watched those 40 satellites burning up just like, oh, man.
Right before it happened, they were like, as long as we can do this, I would feel 100% confident about our future Moon and Mars habitations.
Yep.
And right then, oof, all their satellites blew up.
They all started working on space umbrellas because of those darn solar storms.
It's the scene in Don't Look Up where Mark Rylance starts edging to the side of the room. Oh, well, that's not great.
You know, I like to talk about mid-century communism, Soviet practices.
People can't see this, but right now John is wearing a varsity sweatshirt that says mid-century communism in that fun collegiate font.
Oh my God, if somebody wants to make me a 50s college sweater that says mid-century communism... Oh, I'll wear it every 3 days.
Pulling the hammer and sickle from his varsity sweater. He turns Czechoslovakia back into Slovakia.
Well, Czechoslovakia, of course, one of the sites of mid-century protest against the Soviet sphere.
Until you send in the tanks.
Until you send in the tanks.
Everybody's for fun experimental drama and radio plays in Eastern Europe until you see the Soviet tanks.
And, you know, that famously, if not started, then was, you know, kind of most prominently initiated the whole Soviet tank into town policy. Started in Hungary in 1956.
Hungary kind of invented it.
They really did. They were ahead of the game.
And then it ended in Red Dawn, the movie Red Dawn.
It ended in Red Dawn 2, the one that came.
In Gillette, Wyoming. I don't know. What's the last city to have Soviet tanks going through it? It was Kabul, and then it was whatever city Red Dawn happened
in. I think Red Dawn 2 happened in Spokane or something. It kept moving.
What if Spokane was the last city to be to have Soviet tanks roll through?
I mean, I know it pretty well, so... I feel like we could make a readout there up on the South Hill by some old mansion.
Wolverines!
In Hungary in 56, you know, on the last episode, we talked about General Dwight D. Eisenhower's failings as a president.
As a physical fitness guru?
Physical fitness guru.
Great general, lousy fitness guru. I hate his exercise tape.
Eisenhower also was kind of a bummer in the context of mid-50s anti-communism. You wouldn't think.
He's a bummer in that he was too into it, wasn't into it enough.
This might surprise you to learn, but oftentimes in American politics, what politicians say and what they do can differ by a wide margin.
What?
Yep, I'm afraid so. Often promises are made that then are not fulfilled.
Did Ike's mouth make promises that his butt couldn't keep?
Well, it's much more the conservative movement in general. Now, let us not, on this show, besmirch the reputation of American conservatism. But
that's their job.
In the late 40s, early 50s, they were very virulently anti-communist. Mm-hmm. And they made a lot of big, showy kind of pronouncements.
They had lists of how many communists were in the State Department.
They did. And in,
I have a list right here of weird things you can do with borax. That's all I've got.
It's right here.
I have in front of me a list of 258 weird things you can do with borax in the State Department.
Have you no decency, sir? Yeah, there was a, you know, there was in campaigns again, in particular against Democrats, Truman, etc. Soft on communism was an accusation that was made against anyone that wasn't hard on communism.
If you know what I mean.
And a lot of that rhetoric got pretty amped up by the mid-50s to suggest that America, not only being a beacon of democracy, was also kind of a supporter of global resistance to communism, which we know continued to be American policy. But there was an implication thick in the air that America would actually step in, intervene, not by like fighting Ho Chi Minh in the jungles, but actually like Eastern Bloc.
We'd start rolling tanks into Spokane and Budapest as well.
Yeah, we'd push back against Soviet expansion. And arguably, although it's kind of like this, it's kind of like we see in social media now. It's very clear. It was very, very clearly kind of the way Donald Trump managed his rhetoric. He never actually says explicitly the slander or the promise. You know, he never says take over the Capitol. He says somebody should do something at the Capitol today, this afternoon. And there were a lot of promises made through the instruments of Radio Free Europe and other kind of American propaganda machines in the mid-50s.
It cost us nothing to encourage popular revolts.
Suggesting that revolt in Eastern Europe would produce a successful result. America had your back, in other words.
Instead of just producing a bunch of dead Pole and Czech student leaders.
And the Eisenhower administration very, very definitely wanted to kind of rope in that sentiment as part of their appeal to populism, but they had no intention of intervening in Europe at any time. You know, from the start to the finish, they were like, we're not going to, we might plan the Bay of Pigs because it seems like Castro's a patsy or, you know. How hard is Cuba, right? And that's all Monroe Doctrine driven stuff, but like...
Yeah, Budapest is not 100 miles away from Florida, yeah, so...
Poland? No thanks. But nobody told the CIA. And so in the...
so often seems to happen.
It's weird, right?
What's with the pneumatic tubes that are supposed to go to the CIA? they just don't get to Langley, I guess.
So the CIA actually was like... overflying Hungary and dropping leaflets that said things like the regime is weaker than you think and other kind of incitements. Never take up arms.
Right.
But the regime is weaker than you think. And from the CIA's perspective, I think they expected that would, you know, that people would take baby steps toward democratizing
it slightly
their...
destabilizes, not a lot of downside if it doesn't.
Radio Free Europe also saying stuff like that all the time. The Hungarian station of the Radio Free Europe was full of like bitter hardliners. So of course there was nobody at Radio Free Europe headquarters that was like listening that closely to what the Hungarian station was saying. Right? Like it broadcast throughout Eastern Europe in various languages.
Is that right?
And so, you know, the Radio Free Europe in the Czech language or in Polish or in Hungarian, you know, they had different editorial policy just because of who they had, right? Who was doing the work. And so they were, you know, saber rattling and whatnot.
Because they'd been all the people who had gotten pushed out before, right?
Yeah. And, you know, the CIA was never above collaborating with dubiously nationalist expats.
It never happened in Iraq or Afghanistan, like in living memory, for sure.
And so the Hungarian people, I think famously, because there was an underground economy of information too, right? There was no resistance newspaper, but it was all kind of a word of mouth game of telephone. there grew to be, I think, among the students and the people of Hungary, a kind of idea that they might, well, if they like tried to overthrow the regime, that the West, NATO, Austria, but especially America would have their backs.
Sure.
And so
decide yourself if radio is going to stay. Reason it could polish up the gray. Right?
Right.
Whatever that means.
His lyrics meant nothing then.
I don't even know if those are the right words.
They meant nothing then, and that was what was so great about them. When his lyrics started to be intelligible, it was like when the Smashing Pumpkins started to have intelligible lyrics, you were like, oh no, I didn't really want to know what you thought.
It's just like Trump. If you can't tell what the words actually mean, you're like, this guy has me and my interests at heart.
Yeah.
Michael Stipe knows what my family needs.
Don't look too deeply.
And it's up to par and Katie bar the kitchen door, but not me in.
Yeah. Every once in a while you go, the power lines do have floaters and it's because the airplanes won't get snagged, but I don't want to know the rest.
Yeah, no, like when the first lyrics to appear, I think, are World Leader Pretend on Green, and it's very much like, this is our issue album, and it's important that you read this trenchant commentary. No, pass. No,
nope. It's like if My Bloody Valentine put their lyrics on the records.
Wait, those are lyrics? I thought my ears were just bleeding.
No, they're not lyrics. Although they're better than you think, but they're not good. The Hungarians rose up, and there was a period of 2 weeks where the tanks were, there was this kind of crazy 2 week middle period where it seemed like, oh, maybe this is going to fly. And, after the fall of the wall, once the Soviet archives opened up, it was clear that they kind of were not sure either.
Right.
You know, there
what
was,
do we do?
Yeah, there was Tito, who had his own kind of version of safe from the Russians, pseudo-communism.
I'm my own guy.
I'm my own guy. And I think the Politburo was like, I don't know.
Maybe we just want a bunch of kind of quasi-Marxist border states.
Sure.
Yeah.
But then they looked and the West did nothing. The West was quiet. Eisenhower was super duper quiet.
So you're saying if Eisenhower rolls tanks into Budapest in 56 or whatever this is, Cold War's over by Christmas?
No, I think if Eisenhower had just said something nice.
Oh, I see.
If
he had just eaten some goulash on TV.
Yeah, it was just diplomacy. If the West had been like, we support, you know, unilaterally the Hungarians, and this is, you know, how dare you? I think a free people. I think the Russians would have, I mean, according to their own records, maybe have said, okay, sure, you can be whatever, you know. I don't think the Hungarian people in 56 thought that they were going to become Las Vegas.
No, they just wanted shorter paprika limes.
Exactly. More a chicken in every pot. That's all anybody wants.
Paprika, chicken paprikash in every papri pot.
But then the tanks rolled in, and the rebellion was crushed, and Hungary was
crushed,
and they were super sad and also bitter and cynical and mad.
That's what I meant by crushed. Crushed is a synonym.
Yeah. Well, Orange Crush. The average age of a combat soldier in Vietnam was 19. And that, you know, that Hungarian resentment lasted all the way until now. One might say.
If it's a Hungarian of the correct age.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely have heard Hungarians in Hungary say that America betrayed them.
You guys didn't have our backs.
You know, there's a lot of pro-Americanism still there, but also it's tainted with a feeling that life could have been different. But there's another way of looking at it, which is that the Soviets felt pretty ginger about Hungary, and recognizing that this had happened once, they didn't want it to happen again. And so made concessions, small ones, over the course of the next half century. Well, no, that would have ended in 1990. So not a half century, but you know, the next 30 years, 30 plus years.
That they could have been tougher on Prague or whatever.
Well, they could have been tougher on Budapest and I think by the mid to late 80s, Hungary was the the country in the Warsaw Pact that had the most prosperous and free, you know, relatively free independence.
And that was the gap in the curtain, basically. Once things started to fall apart, like before the wall came down, people started flooding into Hungary.
Right.
And that was where, that was the first leak.
And it was, you know, that was a place where they actually, like, Hungarian leadership went out with wire cutters and started cutting a hole in the fence, right? That was the, that was the place in the summer of 89 where democracy, well, eventually, yeah.
That was the leak in the hot tub of...
The wall opened.
Of communism. In my metaphor, communism is a hot tub.
Communism is a hot tub. I
it's
think
relaxing, but if you stand too long, it's not great.
I think it's compatible. Well, is it compatible with Marxism?
Hot tubs are not compatible with Marxism. No. Unless everybody has one. Unless every collective farm has a hot tub.
And as you know,
and the animals can use it also.
From talking about Marxism with any college freshman, Soviet communism is not compatible with Marxism.
That's true. It's never been tried.
Right. Well, it has been tried.
But I'm just saying what the kid with the Che poster
oh, will sure, tell you. Sure, sure. And we'll get to that in a second, but...
It was betrayed almost immediately.
Almost immediately.
Within seconds of its founding.
Forward a little bit of more than a decade, in 1968, the Czech people also famously revolted against Soviet domination.
It was spring.
It was spring.
Love was in the air.
It was 1968.
Freedom was in the air. They had heard...
Sergeant Pepper.
They had heard Sergeant Pepper.
And they were like, what? What are you talking about?
Circus posters. What is happening in the West?
Who is Mr. Kite and how do I get on board the Mr. Kite train?
It really was us having better youth culture than them.
Yeah. And it was the time of youth culture. And it seemed like, I mean, it was happening in Paris, although more insouciantly, more violently, every once in a while, a woman in a red stocking cap would expose her breast on a barricade. And
it's because the Jefferson Airplane song is that good.
But it was happening globally, and it seemed like now is our time. And certainly the Czech movement was conscious of the Hungarian situation over a decade before and aware that they should be cautious. But the Prague Spring was, you know, like an incredibly successful resistance movement, and it produced a culture in the Czech Republic that was this, you know, it came from a culture of like a literary culture and
arts and culture and student activism.
And also crushed by tanks.
Tanks are the worst.
Tanks.
No tanks. That's what I say.
Yeah, we're against tanks here at Omnibus.
Like an Irish guy being offered non-alcoholic beer. I say,
ouch.
No tanks.
Wow. Slap in the face of all the Irish people that are in AA meetings around the world.
Just out of nowhere, too.
They're like, what?
Hey.
We were just listening to this show, having a good time.
He was
time.
Talking about Eastern Europe, and then suddenly, out of nowhere, pot shot at drunk Irish people.
Yeah, anti-Irish slurs.
It's okay. I can say it.
Why? You're not Irish.
I'm slightly Irish.
How Irish? You do the thing I do, which is
three,
like
30 seconds
Celtic. So
I'm enough.
It's all the same.
5/64 Irish.
So the Prague Spring gets mushed by the Soviet tanks.
By the summer of non-love.
And, but it inspired the, it inspired movements in the Eastern Bloc, and this period in East Europe was a time of inflation. Prices were rising, which is not compatible with Marxism. But
prices are incompatible with Marxism.
They are.
They don't have the prices right there at all.
Wages were stagnant. This all sounds suspiciously like a global economy.
In Soviet Russia, a game show is called "The Central Committee is Right." Am I right, folks?
You are.
Got it.
And in particular, I mean, this was all a kind of a a sentiment. There was at this time now several decades of Warsaw Pact, and there were in all these countries of Eastern Europe that had formerly been part of the flourishing fin de siècle Austria-Hungarian Empire, or whatever Poland, whatever weirdly German-dominated, Prussian-dominated Poland literary societies were, but certainly Prague had these artistic cultures that had enough.
Poland did too, right?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know.
Go ahead. Try and pronounce some.
Vajda and Polanski in film, and I don't know, Jerzy Kaczynski, maybe?
Between the wars? No, you're talking about post-war.
Sorry, I'm talking about post-war.
But there was, you know, all these places, you know, they were deeply cultural places that were not part of the larger Russian universe. And nobody likes being told what to do. Let me tell you that. That's an omnibus standard right there. That's a t-shirt. Nobody likes being told what to do.
Being told what to do is compatible with Marxism, though.
Hey.
The government tells you everything to do.
But in Poland, there was not a literary rebellion at first, but a working class rebellion, which you want to think is not compatible with.
They should be perfectly happy living in a worker's paradise like
they should.
Like mid-century Poland.
Right? Like it's one thing to kill everybody that wears glasses, but boy, if the factory workers don't get on board your worker's paradise.
Yeah, who is it working for?
What are we doing here? And in 1970, there was in the shipyards of Szczecin, there kind of in the northern, what would have been a Prussian kind of state for hundreds of years.
Wow.
But returned...
Finally, returned to its rightful owners.
Returned to the Poles, who...
After years of oppression.
Who kind of didn't even really live there before they pushed out the millions of Germans that did.
But they put consonants back in the name, though. They were happy to have it back.
They were. So Szczecin was, you know, kind of a subsidiary city, I guess, of Gdansk. And they were a shipbuilding center for all of the Soviet bloc, and they had arrived at a place where, you know, there was a food shortage, wages were stagnant, inflation was rampant, and the workers at the shipyard started to protest in the spirit of this time.
Interesting. I wonder what their models are for, you know, for protest. You know, young people in the West have seen examples of successful protests. They see protests near and far on TV. I mean, I wonder what the cultural knowledge is of protest culture in Poland in the 50s and 60s.
Well, there's a lot of awareness of the AFL-CIO. I mean, this is a time in American unions where they've started to become a little bloated with patronage and corruption. But they're coming out of a period of decades where they were truly like a global success story, right? The American unions of the mid-century.
And is that known behind the Iron Curtain?
Yeah. But also...
Interesting. Like that's a, you know, that's a great strength of potential American propaganda. Even though the biggest American propagandists probably hated the unions.
But also in Poland and in the whole Eastern Bloc, there is even just a homegrown sensibility that this is what happens. The workers rise up. And it was the initial premise. And now a real awareness that the workers are kind of taking it in the shorts, and that the Politburo system of perks and corruption had betrayed communism, had betrayed Marxism.
So you can see it as a patriotic movement.
That's right. And there was, you know, there was similarly, I mean, not in these initial protests, but like a sense that just saying the benefits of socialism are bread, butter, and a sausage in every pot isn't enough. That's not the same as as these glimpses of the freedom of the West.
Once you've heard Jefferson Airplane, man,
you can't go back.
How are you going to go back?
So the protests in Szczecin actually resulted in major protests in the streets, the Communist Party headquarters on fire, and then ultimately the secret police machine gunned into a crowd of shipyard workers, killing 30 and injuring 1,000 people.
It's a tragedy, but that's the kind of thing that creates a movement.
Right. And it was, it's one that, I mean, we look at pictures of Prague Spring all the time as a kind of like, this was the 60s, but the Szczecin shipyard protests of 1970s,
they're not emblematic of anything, right?
Well, you know,
they had the misfortune of not coming in the middle of a cultural uprising in the West.
Right. And it did not have, you know, the other two protests, the other two uprisings have both the poetic sense of like a national gesture toward freedom that was crushed by the outside. This was workers arguing for wages and crushed internally by the Polish secret police. So there, it wasn't quite this. You couldn't quite point it at Brezhnev and say Jacques.
Did word get out though? I mean,
yeah, and it was, you know, Nixon era, and so really unclear. This is the problem with this time. Like, these are a left labor union arguing, you know, like violently resisting what would be the global emblem of the leftism,
yeah,
which is state communism. Who's Nixon going to support? Like, which, how far left does Nixon get, go?
Nixon's doing the let them fight me.
He's like, I don't know. But what it does is, because of the secret police crackdown, it sparks within Poland the flame of a resistance movement. And one of the most charismatic kind of man the barricades shipyard workers was a shipyard electrician named Lech Walesa, someone that, you know, what I will talk about a lot in the show. He was not necessarily like an instigator, but he was an articulate guy that could stand up, and he had a good sense of humor. He could rally a crowd, and he had a fantastic mustache. One of the best.
Really great.
He had a great mustache.
You're saying had, but by the way, he's still alive. He still has a mustache.
He does. It's less flourishing. His old mustache, his 1970s mustache, God, it went from ear to ear.
He's gotten broader as his mustache has got, maybe the mustache is the same width and just, he got wider.
He fit. Yeah. There were a lot more sausages in his pot than there might've been in 1970 in recent years.
He now looks like kind of the, like a florid British butcher, a village butcher or some kind of functionary.
And he also, you know, he always had a cigarette. He spoke very plainly. He was not highfalutin guy.
He's not some intellectual, right?
No, he was an electrician and a, you know, like a regular guy, and that appealed to everyone. It did not appeal to the secret police, who
it appealed to everyone except the secret police.
Yeah, who cracked down on him and cracked down on this movement. But by 1976. There was even more kind of economic turmoil in Poland, and there started to come out of this kind of post 1970s post crackdown resistance, a new feeling that this was reaching a boiling point in Poland. And this was mostly invisible to the West, as it remains.
Interesting. Since it turns out to be a real key arena for what ends up happening. I mean, I remember when it got to public awareness in the West. It was before the wall came down.
Oh, yeah.
What year did Valencia get the Nobel Prize?
83.
Okay. That was really the first time, like, I saw any Western news coverage of the movement, honestly.
Oh, well, so So I, you know, as somebody who was around in 1980 and, you know, I was 12 in 1980 and political, it was really huge then.
Is that right?
Yeah. But it really, in 1978, a little something happened called the election of Pope John Paul II.
Right.
To the popage.
Is that what it's called, that little something that happened?
Yeah,
the popage. It was called the election of Pope John Paul II to the popage.
Yeah, he got the popage.
That's what the Wikipedia entry is called.
In 1978. And he, famously, is a Pole, or was. And he was, you know, the first... He was the first Polish pontiff, as we say.
Glass ceiling for so many years.
And he had been the he had been a cardinal in Poland, and he was a anti-communist, as Catholics were during the time. And he believed in, because Poland officially had no state religion, but it was still a very devout country. And John Paul advocated for, you know, the Polish national spirit in as a, you know, as a counter to Soviet communism in Poland, but then in general a kind of anti-communist stance globally. And John Paul,
78, you said, right?
78.
So that's when this starts to make the news, right? When he's, because that's an amazing pulpit for Polish anti-communism.
It is. And he
literally a pulpit.
He actually goes to Poland, and at the time, the Polish government did not think that that was much of a threat. Because
What was their treatment of religion? I guess there was, most of those East German states still had.
Yeah, they were contemptuous of it.
East European states,
sorry. But they felt that they had freed the masses from the jackboot of Catholicism, and really, I think from within their echo chamber, felt like, oh, the Pope's going to come and a bunch of, you know, there's going to be a few hundred little old ladies that go throw flowers at him, but it's going to be a disaster for him, because religion is one of the vices of the West. Well, millions show up for Pope John Paul.
Hometown hero.
Paul. Right. And I mean, even in the United States, the fact that he was Polish was a major...
Yeah, bring that guy to Chicago and look out.
Exactly. It was a big deal. And it kind of inspires, he actually says, like, your loyalty should be to the church and not the state.
Ooh.
He says as much. And the, you know, the Polish government is kind of caught unawares, embarrassed by this. But on the labor side, in 1980, the shipyards in particular are a place where this this kind of discontent is fomented.
Oh yeah, the strike is, I guess, when I started to see this on TV.
Yeah,
not the Nobel Prize.
In 1980, in the summer of 1980, a woman who worked in the shipyards by the name of Anna Walentynowicz.
We'll hear from Poland.
Let's go with that. Anna Walentynowicz.
Please, Poland, help us here. You're our only hope.
She was 5 months shy of retirement, but because she was accused of being active in these kind of, you know, like underground resistance movements, she was denied her pension, 5 months short of retirement. Not compatible with Marxism. And it sparked a ton of, like, protests. And in the Gdansk shipyard in particular, another woman by the name of Alina Plenkowska was kind of instrumental in pushing this. She was a member of the kind of union organizing silent group that, you know, used Anna Walentynowicz's...
Her name has changed since you lost it.
Walentynowicz's forced retirement as a kind of galvanizing moment. And the protests, you know, the protesters were locked out of the Gdansk shipyards, and very famously, Lech Walesa climbed over the fence, and it was a, you know, a real photo op.
Yeah.
They took over the shipyard. They declared Solidarność, this union of solidarity.
This is a new trade union they've decided they're going to form.
There are no independent trade unions.
Not compatible with Marxism.
Not at all. There was a trade union, but it was a state-run trade union called the Polish United Workers Party, and they felt like Solidarność was not compatible with Marxism. When I was a kid, I called it Solidarność because the logo on the N, the farthest pole of the N goes up, and it has a flag flying from it.
Oh, right.
And my child's eye, it looked like an eye. And of course, solidarity, I assumed it was Solidarność.
I think it's weird that you even know the Polish name. Like, the CNN always just said solidarity.
Yeah. Well, so in my culture of, you know, liberal Democrats and pro-union people of the late 70s, like, I had and still have a big button that says Solidarność in Polish.
Oh, it's a flagpole. It's got the Polish flag on the end.
And I used to wear it on my denim jacket.
Yeah.
Like, this was a big moment, right? This was, and very confusing from a general perspective, to support a leftist reply to communism.
Yeah.
Because Pope John Paul was a Catholic, and by its very nature, a conservative, right? The Catholic Church in Poland represented the old guard, a conservatism. He wasn't coming from like a Central American Catholic activism.
Social justice. Yeah.
He was kind of implying that stuff, but it was really appealing to disenfranchised establishment people. But then there was this other excitement that this was a leftist rebellion within Poland. Well, it became global news. And the Polish government, again, caught kind of unawares, initially allowed Walesa, who became the figurehead of the group, and again, he was a tremendously charismatic person. A lot of the initial and then subsequent kind of brain trust behind the union were women.
Huh.
And, you know, outside of Poland, unknown.
Exactly.
Or, you know, they became politicians later, but not part of the story.
It's probably a very canny decision to put the, you know, mustachioed guy out front.
Yeah.
in a traditionalist worker culture.
With his constant cigarette and whatnot. But within very few weeks, there were 20 different unions, and then increasingly more, were formed in different
sectors,
manufacturing
businesses
sectors
are not compatible with Marxism.
And all of these different smaller unions became part of the Solidarity, independent, self-governing trade union. Mm-hmm. And then that extended throughout Poland. There became a rural solidarity of farmers and farm workers until the following year. By 1981, there were 10 million members of the union, which represented about a third of all workers in Poland. And the government of Poland really didn't like it, and they tried a lot of things. They imposed martial law in 1981. They threw Walesa in prison. And I guess I should be pronouncing it Walesa. Walesa.
For some reason, there's a N sound.
Yeah.
Like, why do we say Valencia?
Don't know. Valencia. It's a wonderful place in Spain.
He was from Valencia, California.
And so they spend, you know, they spend most of the 80s trying to beat the union down, and it doesn't ever work. Lech Walesa.
I guess in Polish, that E has a nasal thing on it. The E has a little thing dangling from it, and so that gives it a nasal sound, like when you'd say in France, you know, coq au vin.
So what is it? Valenza.
I think in, you know, it's we often, it's approximated in English with an extra N.
We say Lechwalesa, or at least I always did in the 80s.
Oh, I think I said Valenza.
Valenza?
Yeah.
Well, who knows?
Maybe that's like post Wall Comes Down.
Yeah, it's why we said Budapest instead of Budapest, which we should have done. If you have any complaints about our Polish pronunciations, please write Mindy Jennings at...
She handles all of the Polish phonetics on the show.
So he is awarded the Nobel Prize the Nobel Peace Prize in 1983 for his efforts. And the Polish government, the communist government, is just baffled by this. And
a lot of Nobels for anti-communism at the time.
Yeah.
You know, because at the time, that's the human rights struggle is against a lot of these authoritarian governments on the left.
Exactly. And it was a big, it resulted in a lot of turnover in Polish prime ministers during this, or first secretaries during this brief period. Like, when Solidarity first arose, the head of Poland was Edward Gierela. And he was at first kind of sympathetic, or at least didn't want to crack down on him too hard. The Soviets didn't like it, and he was out. And Stanisław Kania came in, and he was overheard criticizing the Russians on a secret microphone, and he was out.
A hot mic issue behind the Iron Curtain.
It was. And then General Jaruzelski was put in, and now he's a hardliner, you know, an army guy. And they throw it around, and they try all these different things. Well, and Walesa in prison.
I remember Jaruzelski on the news with his big trapezoidal forehead.
Yeah.
He looks like the kind of, like a Jack Kirby idea of what a communist dictator would look like.
Yeah, he was classic, and that was that's peak communist dictator. Think of all the great haircuts and all the great big hats.
And the great glasses frames.
Yeah, and the weird suits that are like, poorly tailored. Like, that seems like a strange way to...
The fur hats were on there just to hide his weird forehead. Like,
right.
You know, that guy wears a skin-tight hat, it looks like a big fur hat.
What was interesting in Poland was that the intelligentsia actually followed the labor union. The intelligentsia was at first kind of like, huh, what, who? You know, they were busy writing poems or whatever intelligentsia do, but they weren't a spearhead of it until the labor unions were getting like all the great press.
The intelligentsia switched to the winning side. We could be doing kinetic sculpture, but we'll go march.
So an artist and kind of theorist by the name of Major Yushchenko, and the title of Major was in ironic mockery of
is that right?
Tendency. They started to stage a kind of contemporaneous and unrelated, like, mockery art project called... So the Orange Alternative was led by a kind of activist and art kook in the 80s East Bloc style by the name of Waldemar Friedrich, which is sort of a Polish spelling of a German name. I have no idea how they pronounce it in Poland, and it's now impossible for me to...
And I can tell you don't even care.
F-Y-D-R-Y-C-H, Friedrich. Let's call it that. And again, right, Mindy? If you are Polish.
Nope, his name's Friedrich now. Too late.
And they called, his nickname was Major Friedrich because it was a kind of joke name to elevate him to the status of, you know, a Polish politician. And the labor unions were, they were spray painting anti-communist graffiti all over Danzig or Gdansk.
I would love to spray anti-communist graffiti all over Glenn Danzig.
Yeah, I know. But he's too small. You only get one little...
You get one letter.
And then the communist regime would come along and paint over all of the graffiti. Unlike the city of Seattle, which apparently has stopped painting over graffiti. If you've driven down I-5 recently,
yep.
It's just, it looks like a...
We're out of gray paint.
It looks like a music video from 1981. But they were Johnny on the spot about painting over the graffiti. And Major Friedrich had the, I don't know, brilliant inspiration that he went and painted gnomes wearing orange gnome hats.
Classic, did you say gnomes?
Classic gnomes.
Are gnomes particularly Polish in the same way that trolls are Scandinavian?
Yeah, I mean, gnomes are, I think all of the area around the Baltic Sea is very gnome. It's gnome turf.
The Poles identify with little gnomes because it's also hard for them to change a light bulb.
Right?
No. Oof,
ouch.
No.
Too soon. We don't do that anymore. They called them dwarves, but we would know them as gnomes. They don't look like hobbit dwarves. They look like, well, they're gnomes.
They got the big peaked hats.
Yeah, they're lawn gnomes. And peaked hats that kind of fall down, they look like a Danish thing, except in Polish. And so his insight was, we can't paint anti-communist graffiti, but if everywhere they paint over it, we just paint gnomes, what are they going to do? They can't arrest you for painting gnomes.
They could paint over the gnomes,
I guess. They can paint over the gnomes, but...
But the gnomes are so powerful and popular that the regime won't dare.
Very quickly, that's what happened. Orange-hatted gnomes became a symbol of resistance against the regime. And although they're cracking down on the labor union, they're jailing the organizers, the secret police is all over them, all of a sudden this kind of, you know, this almost merry explosion of resistance that didn't require that you be a electrician in a shipyard caught on. And so all across Poland, this orange revolution started to happen.
I thought of doing an omnibus about a similar use of humor in the anti-government movement at this time, which was like a rally that centered around, which revolved around ketchup. Do you know this story? The regime, you know, at some point during the struggle during the 80s had, or the protesters who had been told they couldn't wear colors identifying themselves with the labor movement had started to wear Soviet red, ironically. So the government would be in the position of arresting people wearing communist red because they were doing it as a bit.
Right.
And it got to some point in a rally where this guy started putting, a guy in a hot dog stand started putting ketchup on everybody's sausages. And it was getting so into the spirit of the thing that he got arrested. So a man got arrested for putting ketchup on hot dogs, even though ketchup is the color of the Soviet bloc. And this was the kind of thing that like further galvanized the movement. And people started eating ketchup as a symbol of pro-solidarity sentiment.
Maybe that explains the ketchup on spaghetti that I was served so many times in the Czech Republic.
I mean, it's worse than Cincinnati. So yeah, I think this idea that, you know, there's this kind of merry prankster side to protest that the state won't really know what to do with is actually, it actually works.
It does. And in this case, the premise was, are they really going to crack down on gnomes?
Yeah.
Because if they do, they look so ridiculous.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
There was another one where a popular anti-Putin technique now is to release ping pong balls from the parade because everyone looks stupid. And you put little anti-Putin slogans on the ping pong balls, but everybody looks stupid chasing down a ping pong ball.
Yes, they do.
So the second you've got the secret police running after subversive ping pong balls, you have, the state has lost the argument.
Well, this ended up being called the Revolution of Dwarves or the Revolution of Dwarves. Which was great. And that was a big part of what became the Solidarity Revolution. And what happened was, you know, Lech Walesa out of prison, Nobel Peace Prize winner, the government kept needing to meet with him because they believed that he could tame the labor unions, tame the unrest. What if we did this? What if we did that? And eventually, they started to, they started to try and make common cause with him. Now, what was extremely confusing about this time was that Solidarity was supported by all of the leftist movements globally. Most, like the AFL-CIO, got $300,000 together by passing the hat around their membership and sent it to Solidarity in Solidarity.
They were funded from overseas.
In England, the miners' labor union thought that they were betraying the communist cause by fighting against national, you know, communism, by, you know, betraying the Polish Politburo. And so the United Mine Workers of the UK were against Solidarity.
I guess Thatcher era mine workers wouldn't have had much to donate anyway.
But that's partly because Thatcher and Reagan supported Solidarity.
Exactly.
Because it was anti-communist. The CIA secretly sent Solidarity $10 million. But Congress openly, through something I've never heard of called the National Endowment for Democracy, openly sent them $10 million. So
isn't that a problem? Can't the, like,
well, you'd think,
how does an anti-government movement in a police state accept $10 million from the United States Congress?
And the,
it was all in Levi's and Springsteen albums.
The Polish militia and Walesa said something to the effect of like, we don't need money, you know, send us anything, corn, wrenches, like we'll take any support you can, because in response to the regime saying, well, you're funded by the West, he was like, we'll take money from anybody. We're trying to create a workers, you know, this is a workers revolution. Hard to argue. So it was it was globally confusing. And one of the things that the Orange Revolution did was one of the concessions they got from the government was that the union could publish newsletters as long as at the top of the newsletter it said for intra trade union use only. And so then the Orange Revolution, you know, the dwarf hat revolution or the gnome hat gang started publishing anti-government newspapers, and they just put for intra, you know, trade union across the top and got away with it. So by 1988-89, the government was in talks with Solidarity, and by the summer of 89, they conceded that there would be somewhat free elections to the, you know, to the governing body of Poland. The first free elections in Poland since time immemorial. And when they, you know, when these, and what they did was the Polish governing body is called the Sejm, and they said, and they said, we're not going to like make all the seats available, but we'll make 161 seats electable in the group. And then invent a governing body called a Senate, and there are going to be 100 seats in the Senate that will be electable positions. And in June of 89, they had elections. 99 of 100 Senate seats were Solidarity candidates, and all 161 of the contestable seats in the Seju went to Solidarity members. And this was really this is June of 89. This was the thing that lit the torch, because by December of 89, the Berlin Wall was down.
Yeah, it's a very quick series of dominoes at that point.
And, you know, and the Hungarian, like, opening happened right around the same time.
The Hungarian opening.
The Hungarian opening.
It's a chess novel I'm working on.
But it was a, you know, this was the domino effect, and it started here finally with the concession, the enormous concession on the part of the Polish regime to Solidarity. Again, always trying to control them, hoping that this one last concession will bring them under control. And in the end, it spelled the end.
They just had the numbers. They were too big to be ignored.
Yeah. Walesa was elected president. The
first post-communist president of Poland, right?
First democratic president of Poland, and was president of Poland till 95, and he was the one that brought in you know, he privatized all the state businesses. He brought in all of the kind of democratic, that heady time in the early 90s when it seemed like democracy was ascendant and it was the end of history. But unfortunately, he was not as good of a president as he was a labor leader. He didn't understand diplomacy. He didn't, you know, the job of president is a lot of bureaucracy, and he wasn't good at delegating, and he put his cronies in and lost the faith of the Polish people. And the subsequent president came from, you know, he was a communist who changed his tie.
Yeah.
And,
Did Solidarity ever operate as a political party? Is it still a trade union now?
It did. It tried for a while to be a party. It's a trade union now, but it has it only has a million members compared to its 10 million.
Walesa turns 80 next year. Gorbachev's still alive in his 90s.
Yeah, and Lech is what, 78? Something like that?
Yeah, 79, I think.
And so he became a kind of, you know, a sort of problematic figure in, he was a global star. And so he went kind of like you on speaking tours. He gets paid to give inspirational speeches to, I guess, both labor unions and Thatcherite communities.
Right wingers in America, left wingers in Europe. Everybody loves him.
Everybody loves him. And he, he had a post-presidential career in Poland as a statesman.
Do you think he ever just does electrician work still?
He actually, after he lost the presidency in 95, he said, I'm going back to Gdansk shipyard and I'm going to work as an electrician. And he went back and did it, and he was like, wait a minute, this sucks.
This
like,
is way worse than I remember.
I was working with the Pope like, you know, 6 weeks ago. And I don't want to do this, so he stopped. That was a little bit of a funny move.
That's why I always try to fly coach with my kids. You know, you can always ratchet up luxury, but you can't ratchet it back down.
But in a surprising turn, in recent years, there was evidence that Lech Walesa, in the early 70s, right after the big protests in Szczecin, signed an agreement with the secret police to act as an informant.
Really? He wasn't doing a great job. I mean, if you're the leader of the movement, who are you going to turn in besides you?
Right. And he denied it and said, that's just propaganda. That's just trying to, you know, besmirch my memory. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of prominent political brothers in Poland by the name of Kaczynski, and
they're twins, right?
Yeah, and they were early friends who became then, you know, conservative opponents of him, and they really pushed this story. And Walesa kind of sadly, all of his denials felt not very convincing.
Right.
And a lot of them kind of appealed.
How dare you?
And a lot of them appealed to that, that like, you would be nothing without me. I'm the one that freed Poland. How dare you?
How dare you is not a substantive counterargument.
But he said, you know, they're all clearly forged. It's not, it's, you know, this is a campaign, et cetera, et cetera. But in very recent times, a former interior minister, papers came to light when General Czesław Kiszczak, who was the last communist interior minister of Poland, mm-hmm. He had these files that were the secret policeman's ball, the secret police files that indicated that that Walesa had signed commitments to cooperate with the secret police under the code name Bolek. And there were handwriting analysis done, and it was concluded that these were in fact papers signed by him. He made some very confusing denials at one point, saying, oh, well, I might have signed some papers, but I didn't actually do anything.
Well, if that's true, so what happened? He was young and rising in the movement, and
they got
persuaded, but then once he...
They twisted his arm, and he was...
But he couldn't have been informing the whole time. Like, as his stature rose in solidarity, he realized they didn't have as much leverage and stopped working with them.
I think the sense is that in 1970 and 71, he actually kind of informed on his colleagues, but gradually stopped until 1976, when the secret police said he's no longer a valuable asset and we're striking him from the rolls. But whatever, they surely did secret police stuff and leveraged this against him, held his head under a bucket of water, or said that his wife was going to lose her job, or whatever secret police do. But it's pretty clear that he collaborated with them, at least in little bits.
They didn't use it to try to discredit him later, which is interesting.
The communists, yeah, no.
Maybe the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing.
Yeah, and it seems like whatever he did, it was inconsequential. But unfortunately, his after kind of admitting that he had signed these pieces of paper, he then recanted and said, I didn't sign anything, and these are all forged, and this is an attempt to discredit me, and I'm the father of the country, and how dare you? And so sadly, I mean, there's no way that he will ever be dislodged from his status as the leader of this movement that arguably put an end to Soviet communism. But it's just the last little kind of twist that all of our heroes are slightly compromised. Everything is gray in the world. And Lech Walesa maybe is compatible with Marxism, or maybe evidence you can't tax the rich.
And that concludes Solidarność, entry 1187.EC0409, certificate number 26170, in the omnibus. We know that Polish is obviously the lingua franca of the entire United Earth. In the future, you're going to want to send us your pronunciation suggestions.
Yeah.
You can put that to our attention at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick, at Omnibus Project, on various social media platforms.
All of my pronunciations are derived entirely from being 12 years old and seeing all these names in the newspaper and feeling...
I just say things the way Peter Jennings used to say them.
That's right. I was shooting from the hip then, and I'm shooting from the hip now.
You can send your weird L's with lines through them and E's with tails dangling from them in email to theomnibusproject@gmail.com.
Actually, don't. If you think we're really inviting you to, we're not.
We will never need to say the name of these labor leaders of the 70s again.
Or if we do, it's much more likely that saying Lech Walesa is going to be understandable here in the United States than saying...
Exactly. Lech Walesa. This was the 1 hour in my life where I needed to know how to say Valentinovich's name. And I didn't learn, and now it's too late. It's no longer relevant to my interests.
Please don't let that discredit your faith that the Omnibus Project knows what it's talking about.
We know what we're talking about. We're just pronouncing it wrong. You can mail us things to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. What have we here? Two beautifully hand-colored Dayglo postcards.
Those are beautiful.
Of a dragonfly and a squirrel, respectively. You're the dragonfly, I'm the squirrel.
Yes.
Lindsay got some color your own postcards as a Christmas present.
That squirrel has a fern for a tail.
Yes, I get the plant squirrel hybrid because he's cheerful and spunky, but also dependable.
That's you.
Apparently I'm cheerful and spunky. Whereas you get the Dayglo dragonfly because you are psychedelic and groovy, but also with a nature-y... A naturalistic vibe.
True.
Thank you for the New Year wishes, Lindsay Willett, a libertarian crystal futureling. I don't know what that means.
Okay.
The crystals have discovered Ayn Rand, and now we're in trouble. The Borax is...
These are fully written here. Huh?
Lindsay doesn't mess around.
No. The one for you, yes. Mm-hmm. Psychedelic Groovy, right?
Find your fellow futurelings by looking for them online, on Facebook or Reddit, or wherever better podcast fans are sold. You can support the Omnibus on our Patreon the way Joshua did. Today's show was a kind of an outgrowth of a couple suggestions by listener Joshua, who lives in Poland. Is that right?
He lives in Poland? In Szczecin, and he had a lot of things to say about the town and how interesting it was. It's got a Hitler connection. It's got...
Right. I thought we were going to do the...
Yeah.
There's a balcony there where Hitler planned his palace to be.
Better. They built an exact replica of Hitler's offices in the Reich Chancellery in Poland, expecting that that was going to be his forward operating office after they'd conquered Russia.
Wow.
And so all of the times that you see Hitler in his office in movies, it's actually probably filmed in these offices, and they're down to the...
It's a theme park version.
Yeah, down to the little knobs in the desks.
And I think we were resistant to that because, again...
Too much Hitler.
So much Hitler on Omnibus.
But he
more
seems,
than he merits.
He seems to love living in Poland, and Szczecin has a lot of interesting things about it. He really challenged me to pronounce the name right. And I don't think I did.
Szczecin?
Szczecin.
I don't know.
It's got... It doesn't have any T's in it. It's spelled S-Z-C-Z-E-C-I-N.
We don't have a lot of words in English that start with the sch sound.
Yeah, Szczecin. And it sounds like it has like three T's in it to my pronunciation. But he thought it was hilarious to get me to say it multiple times. But I...
Whenever John says Szczecin at home, you should say Gesundheit and have a good laugh.
Should say there's no L in Soviet. But yeah, it was when I realized that the town played a role in the founding of Solidarity, which he pointed out, I felt like, that's the show.
Joshua donated at the Washing Bear level and got to see, and
got at least that much. I said the name of his town 10 times. Well, hope you're satisfied.
We've said his name a few times, too.
Yeah,
if that's what he's in it for.
He's a good guy.
So if you have enjoyed Omnibus, but are not supporting the Patreon, you're at least getting a partial experience. There's a monthly addenda show and lots of other cool perks. Check it out at patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. I'd love to say that whole sentence as fast as I can. It's not even one sentence. I have it written down as two sentences.
I can no longer say it anymore. Like, I just hear the phonetics of it, like, freezing colon and nine cheese oil.
That's right.
I don't even know what I'm saying.
But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.